like to bring this meeting of House Fisheries to order. It is Thursday, February 7th, approximately 10:07. And President Representative Olson, Representative Christ Thompson, Representative Gaddis, myself, Chair Seaton. And at this time, I remind everybody to silence their cell phones. And also, we will address questions through the chair. This morning, we're going to receive a presentation by Dr. Gunnar Knapp on trends in Alaska and world salmon markets. And I also wanted to give a congratulations to Representative Christ Thompson. It's his 24th birthday. It makes some of us feel bad when it's less than half of our age, but we appreciate your participation in fisheries, so happy birthday. And I might just also announce that I was planning on leaving for this weekend to go to my father's 104th birthday, and he is, but he got the flu, and so he didn't want to drive up from Southern California to Sacramento, so we're going to do that in a month or so. But many birthdays around, so let's see. Gunnar, would you go ahead and introduce yourself and a little bit of your background before you start in your presentation, and welcome to House Fisheries.
Okay, thanks. Is this the right volume? You hear me okay? Okay, great. So my name is Gunnar Knapp. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research, or ICER. And as of 4 weeks ago, I'm also the interim director. And just briefly, I might just start briefly by talking about ICER. You know, ICER has been around for 50 plus years and been a center of economic and social research for the state. And as the new sort of incoming director, I'm very interested in making ICER, trying to make ICER as helpful as possible to Alaskans and to the legislature in terms of doing objective public policy research. There's a tremendously talented group of researchers there with a very wide variety of expertise in economics, education, healthcare, energy, many other issues. And if we can ever be of any assistance to any of you folks in the legislature in terms of telling you about research that's been done on a particular topic, or how research could be done, or if we could help you do it, just feel free to give me a call anytime. I'll try to help get you answers. With that background, on to fisheries. So for the past 25 years or so, I've been studying Alaska salmon markets and tracking what's going on in markets. And the background for my visit here today is actually two things. First of all, last April at Comfish in Kodiak, I gave a presentation where I tried to summarize trends over the past 20 years or so in Alaska salmon markets. And then I tried to just summarize the data that I track from year to year and try to update every year. And then just last week I was at a big what was called the Global Seafood Markets Conference down in Santa Monica, California, which is sponsored by the National Fisheries Institute, and I was sort of giving a presentation and participating in a panel on sort of global salmon markets. And so I thought, well, I could perhaps put those two presentations together and give you folks just sort of a summary of what Alaska and world salmon markets look like and what the trends have been and sort of what the current situation is. And so this is sort of a long and detailed presentation. It's a little bit like a sort of maybe like a class. So speed me up if you want to, or slow me down, or stop, or interrupt me, or whatever. I'm not going to get into any kind of politics or policy issues or anything. I hope, almost entirely non-controversial presentation, just trying to show you what some of the data look like and what some of the numbers and trends are. And I apologize for making it so complicated, but I think that one of the key things is you kind of have to get into the details to begin to understand what's going on in salmon markets and the salmon industry. So I'm going to post this presentation online at my website, and you folks also have it. With regard to the printed presentation, I made just a couple changes in what I'm showing here, which come towards the very end. I spotted a couple typos. What I'm going to talk, first of all, is about, first I'm going to talk about trends in Alaska salmon markets, catches, production, end markets, prices, value, permit prices, and so on, and then trends in world salmon markets, and sort of how they relate to Alaska salmon markets. And then I'm going to talk about some of the factors that affect salmon markets and about the future outlook. And I've got some stuff on my data sources in this presentation, but I'm not going to go get into that. And this is a basic summary of the main points I'm going to be making and that I think are kind of the most important and interesting trends. First of all, Alaska salmon harvests in recent years, actually in recent decades, have they vary a lot from year to year, but generally harvests have been strong. And most of our salmon resources, contrary to what gets the headlines, most of our salmon resources are in relatively good shape and in good condition, although the harvest, the 2012 harvest, was a little off. But in general, our salmon resources are in good shape. Secondly, there's some interesting trends going on in what's products were produced from Alaska salmon. One of the most interesting ones is that whereas pink salmon used to be almost entirely canned, recently a much, much larger share is being frozen. Our frozen salmon markets, which are our most important ones, are significantly diversifying. This is one of the most important changes over the past decade. We're far less dependent on Japan than we used to. We're exporting more to the EU, to China, and we're consuming a lot more in our U.S. domestic markets. And this diversification is a good thing. It's increasing our markets, and it's giving us many more market options, making us far less dependent on Japan, and it's really a dramatic change.
Let me interrupt for a second. The statement on pink salmon more being frozen now, mm-hmm. Is there ultimate disposition? Is that just moving the canning operation from here to, say, China, or is
I'm not getting into that in more detail.
Okay.
It's in short, the short answer is a lot of this pink salmon is being frozen, and also chum and sockeye, and it's being exported in significant, very significant volumes to China, where it's not being canned, but rather thawed out and reprocessed into a wide variety of value-added products. And I've got some pictures of that coming up,
great,
too. I think the most important news is that there's been an enormous rebound in prices and value since 2002. Certainly, the salmon industry had a major economic crisis throughout much of the 1990s and sort of the, around 2001, 2002 was sort of the really sort of worst of it. And since that time, things have tremendously rebounded. The industry is much stronger, and it's a dramatic change. So the people that are still in the mode of thinking, oh, the commercial salmon industry in Alaska is dead or dying, that picture's way out of date, and there's a new picture, which is a much brighter and stronger picture. Both fishermen and processors have shared in that improvement, and permit prices have increased dramatically. And I'm going to be illustrating all this. Now I'm going to go to world salmon markets. There's been an enormous growth in world salmon supply over the past three decades. That has been driven by salmon farming. And farmed Atlantic salmon in particular now accounts for two-thirds of world salmon supply. This growth in supply would not have been possible without a corresponding enormous increase in world demand for salmon. All over the world, people are eating more salmon and in more places. There are major new markets that never existed, like Russia, Eastern Europe, and Brazil. And farm salmon prices were strengthened throughout much of the 2000s by this very dramatic growth in demand, and indeed prices spiked in 2008, sort of 2008 to 2010. But then prices crashed And the cause of this spike and crash was a major disease problem that happened in Chile from which they're now recovering. And so we're at an uncertain time in world farm salmon markets where sort of what happens in production will affect what happens in prices. And this, what's happening in the farm salmon markets affects wild salmon, and it's particularly important where wild salmon is competing directly with farm salmon in the frozen H&G, frozen fillets, and fresh markets. That's what I'm going to say, and now I'm going to illustrate it with 933 graphs. Well, actually, slightly fewer. So let's start by just talking about trends in harvests, which is the starting point. Let's see, what do I hit here? How do I make this go forward? Oh, the arrows. Okay. Yeah. So I think many of you are probably familiar with this sort of basic graph that shows the total volume of salmon harvests. And our big three species are sockeye, pink, and chum. And if you just look at this graph, the Chinook salmon is that tiny little bit of green on the bottom, and the coho is also very small. So sort of even though Chinook deservedly is sort of in the news today a lot because of some really severe problems in a few specific parts of Alaska, the bulk of the commercial salmon industry is sockeye, pink, and chum. That's sort of where the action is in terms of most of the value and most of the catches, and that's mostly what I'm going to talk about. This graph shows the same information, but sort of with different lines for different species, and you can see some different trends that are going on. Basically, the pink salmon fluctuates very widely from year to year. There tends to be an even year, odd year pattern, but it doesn't always follow that. So pink salmon harvest can vary dramatically, both statewide and by region. Sockeye have fallen off from the very high harvests of the early 1990s. They were quite low in the late 1990s, early 2000s, then came back. Last year, they fell. This year, they're probably going to fall again, according to the state's Bristol Bay projections. And chum have been fairly consistent and strong. And I don't have a graph to show this, but hatcheries are a major part of the chum and pink production and a major contributor to those. Now, let's look at what products are being produced from these salmon. And this is data from the Commercial Operator Annual Reports, and the data only it comes in. Processors file these sort of in April after a season, and so we don't have the data for 2012 yet because the processors haven't even sent in that information. But this shows the data through 2011. This is the data for sockeye, and the blue is the frozen production. The green is the fresh, and the red is the canned. And you can see that blue, green, and red, frozen, fresh, and canned are all important sockeye products. But frozen is the most important. This graph shows the same information, but in sort of percentages. And you can see that in the past decade, the frozen and fresh share have been rising, and the canned share has been declining. My understanding is that a lot of the fresh sockeye is coming out of Southeast Cook Inlet, areas on the road system or southeast. It's easier to transport to fresh markets in the U.S. A larger share of the frozen and canned is coming out of Bristol Bay. Moving on to pink salmon, here this graph shows this dramatic increase in frozen pink production that's occurred over the past decade, and this is the same graph showing the there's sort of a change in the relative share of pink from, 80% canned to like, less than a third canned, or only about a third canned in 2011. And then finally, if you go to chum salmon, there's some fresh production, but basically most of the chum salmon is frozen. Okay, now this graph combines all the
you know, all the different products of all the different species for Alaska salmon. And the main point there is that if you sort of look at all the products that are produced from all the different species, five products account for the vast bulk of what's produced in the Alaska salmon industry. And those products are frozen sockeye, frozen pink, frozen chum, canned pink, and canned sockeye. And if you think about value, another one is roe, which is a significant part of value, and I'll talk about that later. The roe volume isn't so great, but the value of roe is important. I'll talk about that later. I want to show you some pictures of Chinese salmon reprocessing. And later I'll show you some graphs that show you how dramatically the exports to China have increased. This is just to give you some feel for this. So a lot of the frozen product produced in Alaska, increasing share is being frozen H&G and then shipped to China. And these are all pictures I took 3 or 4 years ago when I was visiting some plants in China. Yeah.
Can you explain for anybody listening H&G?
H&G means headed and gutted. Yeah, headed and gutted.
Just
salmon.
To make sure.
So we'll actually see some. So it gets shipped over in these cardboard boxes, and then the first thing that they do is they thaw the fish out, then they fillet them, and then the pin bones are pulled by hand. And then these boneless fillets are placed in trays for freezing. And after freezing, in this particular plant, and you can have different things going on in different plants depending on what they were producing. In this particular plant, at the time I was visiting, they would freeze these fillets and then cut them into portions. And this is different species. Then they get packed up and put in a box of frozen coho fillets, which can then get shipped off to markets. Some gets shipped back to the United States, some goes to Europe, some goes to Japan. So these plants are getting this frozen product from the United States and doing this sort of value-added processing. And it's not just Alaska salmon. It's also Alaska pollock. It's also Russian salmon. It's also Russian pollock. It's also shrimp from all over the world. It's the entire world seafood industry has been experienced a fascinating phenomenon over the past decade, under which labor prices are so much lower in places like China, Vietnam, Thailand, that processors around the world have found it cheaper to freeze the product, ship it to these low-wage countries, reprocess it, and then ship it back to wherever they're going, rather than process it in these countries. There's the label on a box of chum salmon, and this is a cover. This is the cover of a box in this particular plant for one of the value-added products that was produced at this plant. And I went in the office, and they had like 80 different boxes there of all kinds of products in all kinds of languages. So this stuff is getting boxed up and made for consumer-ready products, like in this case, Europe. And the thing you notice in these plants is they're just employing enormous number of workers, and there's very, very little equipment. Most of the work's done by hand. This kind of processing would be extremely expensive to do in Alaska, which is why it doesn't happen here.
It is interesting noticing that in the plant and the previous one, that every worker has a mask on.
Yeah.
It looks like interesting health and safety concerns. Is that something that they market?
It's pretty interesting. I've had the opportunity, a very interesting opportunity over the past two decades to visit a tremendous number of fish processing plants in many different countries, including in China. And Something that has always struck me is that in many of these plants, like in Norway, in Chile, in Iceland, in Canada, in China, often the sort of attention to, I don't know, hygiene or food safety or whatever has seemed to be a few years ahead of what I've observed visiting in Alaska. Everybody wearing masks, everybody, you know, like in Alaska, it's one boot bath, and, you know, in some of these places, it's three different ones, and, you know, and make it, you know, hair nets, and it's like the, I've observed over time the same things happening in Alaska, but often some of these places are ahead of us. So we tend to think of ourselves as sort of the state of the art, but it isn't necessarily so, and I think that there's sort of in particular, China has a bad reputation with respect to a lot of products, and, you know, is it safe and so on. I think that these plants that are producing for re-export, be one thing if you're producing for the Chinese domestic market, but if you're producing for re-export and your customers are companies like Walmart or Sainsbury or in Europe or so on, their inspectors, those company inspectors are crawling all over that place to make sure it meets international standards. And that's just the trend in the world. Everywhere, certainly Alaska too, is going towards super, super clean, super attention to detail.
Representative Guy Thompson.
Are there possible improvements in processing technology where what currently has to be manually processed could be automated, and with the removal or reduction of labor cost, processing, like this kind of processing, could be cost competitive in Alaska?
I don't have these slides here, but I visited salmon processing plants in Norway, which is like the polar opposite. This picture, all you see is people. In my pictures of the Norwegian plants, all you see is machines, and there's like three guys, and they're just like inspecting the machines to make sure they're working, and like the fish are, you know, it's like the machines are doing everything, all the sorting and so on. So very sophisticated machinery exists, and you'll see a lot of it, by the way, if you visit fish plants around Alaska. There's just been tremendous investment in the Alaska salmon industry, and you know, over the past decade. And so for example, out in Bristol Bay, just this past summer, I was seeing new lines in brand new lines where they had all kinds of sophisticated filleting and portioning machinery and so on doing this, which makes it possible also to produce, makes it economically possible to produce these value-added products. An interesting issue is these countries like China are now experiencing increasing labor costs. And so this may be a temporary phenomenon, China doing this kind of stuff, and companies maybe end up shipping less in the future to China because the cost advantage is less, especially as this machinery improves.
Follow-up, Representative Cash Thompson.
I guess sort of two parts. One is, are you seeing indications that processing is shifting from China back to the United States or to Alaska? And watch it, just from...
Well, first of all, one thing that I just observed in general in processing, the processing industry in Alaska and around the world has been continuously changing for as long as I've been looking at this industry, which is only 25 years. But it goes back before that. I mean, 50 years ago at statehood, this was entirely a canned salmon industry. And then freezing came in, and then fresh technology and filleting came in, and all this stuff's been going on. And so it's continually changing. And there's a tremendous amount of investment going on, especially as prices improve. By the way, it's making these new products, these new value-added products, that's both the farmed industry and the wild industry that has allowed demand to increase and to diversify these markets. That's how we get into the EU. That's how we get into the U.S. domestic market, by like all these sockeye fillets and sockeye portions and salmon burgers and all this stuff that you see. So there's a just... I'm getting off on a tangent. I don't know. there's a lot of change going on, there's a lot of investment, and there's a lot of new potential. And it's happening continually.
Thank you, Representative Gaddis.
And quick question, in regards to freezing in Bristol Bay, and I admit to having some inside knowledge having fished Bristol Bay, but could it be said that the one of the reasons that they're going to frozen is just to keep up with capacity, just to keep up with the canneries?
What actually is happening more and more in the larger fish processors in the state, the companies that, you know, with large plants and large volumes, mm-hmm. They actually have the capacity to produce multiple kinds of products. They've got either within a particular plant or within different operations. So depending upon market conditions, they can say, we're going to can more this year, we're going to put it in tall cans, we're going to put it in quarter cans, we're going to put it in half cans, or we're going to freeze it H&G, or we're going to fillet it, or we're going to make portions. And they literally, from week to week, so for example, and I'll get into this summer, the Japan H&G market was depressed, and so processors were running away from that market. Those that could were trying to find other things they could do with sockeye. So they were actually going back to canning this summer, and because the canned market was really strong, mm-hmm. or they were portioning because the portions market was strong. So there are more and more they have flexibility, whereas it used to be that like Bristol Bay, you know, you had a cannery that could can, or you had a a floater that could freeze, and they had very little flexibility. It's still the case in fisheries like Bristol Bay and certain other fisheries, if you get a high volume period, if you get a few days where there's just an enormous run, then the only way they can run the volume through the plant before the fish spoil is they've got to can them and they've got to freeze them. Because it takes, you just cannot handle the volumes. Like, if we really wanted to get the highest possible value out of our Alaska salmon, everything would be portions and fillets and so on, but we can't physically, in the peak of the season, we can't do that. So often what you'll have is at the earlier in the season or later on the shoulders or on low volume days, they'll be running that stuff to the portion lines or fillets. At other times they'll be saying, just freeze it as fast as you can or can it as fast as you can.
So in that short answer, what you're really saying is that capacity and cannery capacity don't tend to drive really what the market really drives.
I'm saying the market is becoming increasingly important, but in those fisheries that have really high volumes in a compressed period of time, mm-hmm. such as Bristol Bay being right. the ultimate, in those fisheries, depending upon the year, you can have situations where capacity, you only have one choice.
Got it. Thanks.
Good. The rate I'm going to should be done by 3:30. Let's see. Now, this is the eyes glaze over section, so I'm going to go through it really quickly. And also, I didn't get a chance to update these data. And so they're like from 2010. And this is way too hard to read, so I'll just go to the next line and talk about it. I was interested and have been interested for a long time in understanding kind of, well, where does our Alaska salmon go? So all of our Alaska salmon goes, first of all, it either gets canned or frozen or fresh, and then it goes somewhere. And how do we tell where it goes? Well, since Alaska is, 98% of the picture of U.S. salmon harvests, if we just look at U.S. salmon exports, almost all that is Alaska salmon exports. So anything that gets exported from the United States is part of where Alaska salmon is going. And then you can kind of guess, you can sort of backwards out, figure out what must have gone to the U.S. market by if you take what was processed in Alaska of any given product, whatever didn't get exported is what stayed in the United States. So ironically, we have much more accurate information about how much we export than we have about what goes to our own U.S. market
because nobody fills out a form if they send fish to Seattle. They fill out a form if they send fish to Japan. So that's what I've done. So in these graphs, and this is the graph for frozen sockeye, and I got a bunch of other graphs that are similar. The green line at the top is the total Alaska production of frozen sockeye. And then the blue is the total exports. So the difference between the green and the blue is what presumably stayed in the United States, or a rough estimate of it. And then some of the lines below that show exports to specific countries. And so the most interesting thing about this graph, if you sort of study it for a few minutes, the most probably the most important change in all of Alaska salmon is that sockeye is our most valuable species. Frozen sockeye is our most valuable product. If you look back to the 1990s or 1980s, almost all that frozen sockeye was exported, and almost all those exports went to Japan. So we were extremely dependent on the Japanese frozen salmon market. And now if you look forward into the 1990s and into the 2000s, you can see that we're no longer exporting almost all of it. A significant portion is staying home in the United States. And secondly, of the part that we're exporting, far less is going to Japan. And significant volumes are now going to China and the EU. So that's diversification. And this graph shows...
Griffin M. Gaddis.
Yes, ma'am.
And this just brings a question. If Japan is not buying as much, who are they buying from?
Who's Japan buying from?
Correct.
Ah. Well, several...
I don't want to make a long thing, but I mean, have they decided to buy from somebody else rather than Alaska? Well, so they're buying, but just from somebody else. Is that...
Several things are going on. First of all, they're buying farm salmon.
Okay,
and
that's
farm
where
cow.
It's going.
They're, and they have been, and this was what caused...
Right.
This is what started the whole mess.
When the Chileans
started exporting large volumes of frozen coho to Japan, mm-hmm. competing head-on with the Alaska sockeye, it just sort of, at that point, and that was sort of back in the late 1980s, mm-hmm. early 1990s, at that point, we didn't have any other markets. We were totally dependent on this mm-hmm. market, and suddenly there's all kinds of competition going in, and that was one of a number of factors that really crashed the prices of Alaska salmon in the 1990s. But since then, with the Japanese prices falling, people said we got to diversify. And this graph shows how we've diversified. And you can see the frozen Alaska frozen salmon, well, one, we're producing less of it. That's because the harvest declined. But now the red, which is the Japanese share, is much, much lower. And we're exporting a lot of it to the EU and to China and Canada. Some of that stuff going to Canada is actually being thawed out and canned. And then the U.S. So it's really a story of diversification.
And 2011 and 12, you are those same?
It's a similar picture in 2011. So we don't. I have the 2011 numbers, but I confess I ran out of time this morning to update this set of graphs. But I'm going to give you guys an updated version that has the numbers. In 2012, we don't have yet. But it would show the same pattern. Now, here's the number for frozen pink salmon. Remember the five main, I'm going to show you these graphs for the five main product categories. And you can see there's been this huge increase in frozen pink production, which we talked about, and almost all of that's being exported, and almost all of that's being exported to China. And so here's the sort of my estimates of where the frozen pink is going. And you can see China and also Thailand, and it's not because they eat frozen pink salmon in Thailand, it's also another major reprocessing center. This is a graph for frozen chums, and here is an interesting phenomenon. A lot of frozen chums used to go to the U.S. market. But now, what's happened, there's been a shift from the U.S. market to the Chinese market for these frozen chums. The frozen chums are getting, in significant part, reprocessed. So again, here's the graph of where the frozen chums are going.
the canned markets, I'm not going to talk much about canned markets, have seen a lot less change. Basically, over all this period, most canned pink stay in the United States, where canned pink salmon is a regionally important product. If you go to a store in Seattle, you're not going to, or you know, Portland or San Francisco, you're not going to see much canned pink salmon. But if you go to a store in Nashville or Atlanta or Raleigh, North Carolina, you're going to see a lot of canned salmon. And just as a short anecdote, I was sitting in my home 2 Saturdays ago, minding my own business, and this elderly gentleman called me up at my home from North Carolina and said, "We're in a senior citizens group, and we're interested in why the price of canned sockeye salmon is so high this year. Because we eat a lot of that stuff, you know, and we want to know why it's so high." Somebody tracked my name down. So I guess senior citizens groups in Portland wouldn't call you about that. And so that's kind of my estimates of where canned pink goes. And then canned sockeye, the graph's hard to follow, but basically most of it goes to the former British Commonwealth, and in particular the United Kingdom. And a lot of that stuff that's going to Canada is later being re-exported, I think. The Canadians are not eating that much canned sockeye. Okay, so now let's talk market. So far we've just been talking what's produced and where it goes. So if you look at prices, the story going back 22 years is a dramatic fall in prices during the 1990s and a dramatic rebound in prices since 2002. But in this last year, 2012, this last season, the ex-vessel prices dipped. They fell off a little. Now, to a certain extent, that dip it's not actually as large as it seems, because these are preliminary price estimates from the Department of Fish and Game, and they don't incorporate the post-season adjustments that hadn't been made as of the time these estimates came out in 2012, and some of which may still be made. But still, I don't know what those post-season adjustments will be, and I wouldn't risk predicting that, I don't think the price dip will be as great as shown here, but I think it's likely that 2012 prices are going to average lower than 2011. So we'll come back to why that dip happened. It's important when we look at how we prices today and we do this long-term comparison that we realize there's been a lot of inflation. A dollar had twice the purchasing power in 1984 that it had in 2012. Or it had 30% more in 2002 than in 2012. So if you adjust for inflation, then we've still had a major price recovery since 2002, but we haven't done as well as getting back towards the prices that, you know, the real purchasing power of what salmon prices were in the 80s. So it's a lot better than 2002, but it's not back to what it was in terms of the real that purchasing power of salmon prices. How about first wholesale prices paid to processors? We have two different data sources, and one is the Commercial Operator Annual Reports, and I'll just sort of go through this quickly. And I didn't go around to updating these data, but what you basically see is the rebound in prices, the fall in the 80s and 90s and the rebound, you see it in the wholesale prices too. This is wholesale prices for sockeye, the different products. This is wholesale prices for pink, and this is wholesale prices for chum. So basically what's happened is in these markets, you know, this is simplifying, in the 90s, the prices were falling for processors, and the processors passed a lot of that on to fishermen. Both processors and fishermen were really hurting. Since then, it's worked the other way. Here are roe prices. And this is the only thing I say about roe. Roe markets are completely different from all these other markets. Roe doesn't compete with farm salmon. Salmon farmers don't don't produce roe, or very little of it. And so this is driven entirely by wild harvests and roe production from wild harvests, and by the particular roe market conditions in Russia and Japan, which are the major roe markets. And there's what happens with Russian roe production is a big factor. And so it's just different stuff going on. Roe prices have been pretty strong in recent years. This is more recent, recent data. This is the data the Department of Labor, Department of Revenue collects on every 4 months on wholesale prices for different products. And actually, fishermen pushed for the Alaska Department, and the legislature passed a bill starting about 10 years ago for processors to report this information so that fishermen would have more up-to-date information on what's happening in markets. And so these data go through the last 4 month period the middle 4 month period of 2012, so it's mainly sales during the May to August period. And you can see that canned salmon prices have been really, really strong the past few years. And this year, canned salmon prices were just very, very high. And this is due basically to a shortfall in production in 2011 and just lower sockeye salmon production harvest this year and strong canned salmon demand. This is a really good news point. You know, our old-fashioned product that people used to sort of hate the idea that we depended on canned salmon, but it's a really great... By the way, canned salmon, we forget this, is a value-added product. It's a consumer-ready product made in Alaska. Interesting thing to think about. And it's been a strong product in recent years. In contrast, wholesale prices for frozen and fresh salmon fell this year. I'll talk in just a little bit about why this happened. But this is basically what drove the fall in ex-vessel pricing to fishermen this year. Lower wholesale prices for frozen and fresh salmon. This is frozen fillets. Actually, the fresh salmon prices only fell for sockeye, but not for chum and pink. So, just as we saw with the fishermen's prices, the wholesale prices for frozen and fresh this year were off. And not off by a lot. Things are still hugely better than they were back in 2002, but still, it wasn't like, 2012 was a reminder that path isn't necessarily infinitely upwards from here on. So I'll talk about that. And this is roe. Again, 2012 was a good year for roe and driven by totally different things. Now how about value? The 2012 value, according to the preliminary pictures, sort of the total value to fishermen was about the same as, this is just through 2011. I didn't update these data. I'm sorry. I haven't updated this graph. I think it was actually a little lower this year in 2012 because of the lower sockeye harvest and lower prices. So I should have updated this. I'll update it in the next electronic version I'll get you. This graph is worth studying. This is the sort of inflation-adjusted total value through 2011. And you can see fishermen earned total value in 2011 almost three times as high as what it was in 2002. So it's been a tremendous recovery in value. But the sort of inflation-adjusted value is still well below what it was in the peak years of the 1980s. So I think it's basically a very good news story, but it's not like it's back to what it was at the very peak. How about wholesale value? This is the trend through 2011 in wholesale value. And again, this is a enormous good news story, just tremendous increase in value since 2002. And it's come in the value of all these products, in the frozen sockeye, the frozen pink, Canpink less the increase. Roe, and this graph is useful for seeing sort of the relative importance of Roe, that's that pink near the top, in the total value. Roe is an important component, a significant component of total wholesale value of Alaska salmon. By the way, particularly for chum salmon.
Representative Gaddis.
Speaking of Roe, you had mentioned a little bit further back that farmed salmon doesn't produce much Roe or any Roe. What's the reason for that?
Salmon farmers don't produce much Roe. That's the point. Now, they got female farmed salmon and they grow. The biology works just the same. Uh-huh. If the salmon farmers harvested their salmon at the time and in the condition that we harvest wild salmon, then they get a lot of roe too. But they can make more money. They get higher quality, and also they don't have to wait as long. They harvest their fish earlier.
I understand.
And also, an Atlantic salmon is a different beast.
Yeah, I just never thought about that. Thank you.
So, I've been told, by the way, that farmed salmon roe is like really good, mm-hmm. And it's really high quality. It's just that's not the optimal way for a salmon farmer to use that fish.
I understand.
Thank God. at least from a roe perspective.
Right.
This graph shows through 2011. If you take that total first wholesale value, and then you take the total ex-vessel value, which is the blue line. So the red line's the sort of total first wholesale value, and the blue line's the total ex-vessel value. Then the green line is just the top line, the red line minus the blue line, and it's what I call the total processor margin, the sort of value that gets added in processing. And we could talk and debate about this line for a long time, but I think the main point is that both processors and fishermen have shared in this recovery of value and in the sort of recovery of prices. I'm sure a lot of people would like to debate whether they shared the right amount or whatever, but in general, both sides of the industry have been sort of experienced the decline in the 90s and have shared in the rebound. Now, just briefly on permit prices and earnings. So far I've been talking about the Alaska salmon industry as if it was sort of just one big fishery. But actually it's 27 different limited entry salmon fisheries. Each one is a different situation, a different mix of species, different catch trends, some of the fisheries like the Yukon River fisheries are obviously a drastically different picture than what we see here. This graph shows the earnings in two of Alaska's most valuable salmon fisheries, the Bristol Bay Drift Gillnet and the Southeast Purse Seine. But every salmon fishery in the state would show a different trend reflecting catches and prices and so on in those fisheries and the species mix. But almost all of them would show a big drop in total earnings in the 90s and a major recovery in the 1990s, not every one. And then almost every one will also show a significant rebound in permit prices since 2002. And basically what tends to happen in these salmon fisheries is, in 2002, I think many of Alaska's salmon fisheries were essentially, there was no profit in it. And what you were catching was outweighed by the cost of catching the fish. And so these permits were going for unbelievably low prices compared to what they'd been selling for 10 years earlier. So the fishermen at that time experienced a terrible drop in their permit investment. And since that time, the outlook has gotten much better, and so the permit prices have come back, which is great if you've been owning a permit during that time. The downside is that if earnings ever fell again, then you could see permit prices fall again, or that's what you'd expect. But there's I think the rise in permit prices reflects the optimism of salmon fishermen reflecting the change in market conditions. Okay, now let's switch gears and look at the world salmon situation, which we need to pay attention to understand the broader context of the situation we're facing. I think that the important message I want to make here is that Alaska has become a relatively small part of total world salmon supply. This graph goes 30 years from 1980 to 2009, and which is sort of the latest for which I have complete data. And if you go way back to 1980, look at that very left-hand most thing. Now, the orange at the bottom of the graph is Alaska sockeye salmon, and then you got a little bit of gray that's chum salmon and Alaska pink salmon. And then the green is all the other wild salmon in the world. And 1980, and then the blue and yellow is farm salmon and farm trout, or the kind of farm trout that is raised in salt water and sort of is similar to farm salmon. 1980, there's hardly any farm salmon in the world, and Alaska salmon was like 40% of the world harvest. And furthermore, a lot of the other wild salmon was Russian salmon, which was only marketed in the Soviet Union. And so it didn't enter world markets. So we were the name of the game in world salmon markets. And since that time, our harvests have grown a little, but basically have stayed sort of at roughly the same level. And there's been this, as have the rest of the world's wild salmon harvest, but there's been this phenomenal increase in farm salmon production. And it's totally changed the world salmon picture. And furthermore, the other wild salmon, much more of it enters world markets, the Russian salmon in particular. And so there's been a dramatic change in world markets, where we're now a small part of the total supply picture. This graph shows since it's the same graph on a squinched up scale, so the growth looks more dramatic. And this is by species. And you can see that farmed Atlantic salmon dominate, and also this goes through 2012. Farmed Atlantic salmon dominates world production. This is why if you go into markets, if you go into stores in most parts of the United States, other than like Alaska and the Pacific Northwest, and especially in Europe, which is where the by far the largest market for salmon, it's overwhelmingly farmed Atlantic salmon that you see. Now, let's look at farmed Atlantic salmon. This is just farmed Atlantic salmon. And this is the supply picture over the past 11 years for farmed Atlantic salmon. And the major producers are Chile, Norway, and then all other countries, which include Scotland, Canada, and the Faroe Islands, and Iceland, and various other places. But Chile and Norway are the big bulk of production. And in this graph, you see something extremely important that happened since 2008. Chile had a disease crisis of a disease called infectious salmon anemia, ISA, and it caused an enormous drop in their production between 2008 and 2010. And since then, the production has basically recovered almost to its former level. And that has contributed to this enormous increase in total supply. And then this is another way of looking at the same numbers. It isn't just the rebound in Chilean production, which is shown by the line at the bottom. It's also Norway continued to grow dramatically during this time period. So the Norwegians and Chileans over the past 2 years have been dramatically increasing their production. So the world's farmed Atlantic salmon production really spiked since 2010.
Yeah, Representative Chris Thompson.
going back a few slides, what's a quick breakdown of the world wild salmon supply? What countries is that wild salmon coming from?
In brief, and I mercifully spared you my 50 slides showing the sort of detailed breakdown of world wild salmon, but basically the world's four wild salmon producers are Alaska, Canada, Japan, and Russia. Canada's about a fifth to a sixth to a seventh of Alaska supply, and their production's been declining. So Canada's kind of become a bit player in wild salmon. Russia and Japan both produce about half the volume of Alaska. The Russian production is overwhelmingly pink salmon, and that pink salmon varies enormously from year to year. So you get years when the Russians just catch phenomenal volumes of pink salmon, and to a lesser extent, chum salmon, and much lesser extent, sockeye. So you got this Russian pink that's out there, and it's more pink than Alaska produces, and it fluctuates hugely from year to year. And then you've got Japan, which produces phenomenal amounts of chum salmon, which is entirely from hatcheries in northern Japan. So you've got huge amount of chum from Japan, huge amount of pinks from Russia, and small amounts of the other species. Now, this is sort of my estimates of U.S. salmon consumption of frozen, fresh and frozen salmon. And what I did was I took our imports into the United States and I added my estimates of what we produced domestically from Alaska. I talked to you before about how those are sort of really rough estimates. It's based on subtracting our exports from our frozen production. And you can see that in the United States domestic market, it's dominated, the blue, red, and green, the bottom three colors, is all imported Atlantic salmon. And then the next line is imports of unspecified frozen fillets. That's probably mostly Chinese reprocessed salmon coming back from China. Okay, I need to break that down more to show you. So that would probably be wild, you know, a large part of that is Alaska wild salmon, but also some Russian wild salmon that's coming back. And then you see the Alaska categories at the top. So my point is, Alaska wild salmon is certainly important in the U.S. market. If you go to our stores in Alaska, you see it. If you go to any good quality store, Whole Foods or whatever around the country, you'll see, or Costco around the country, you'll see frozen Alaska salmon. But in terms of the total volume being marketed in the United States, it's dominated by Atlantics.
Representative Craig Thomas.
Is there any appreciable supply of wild salmon from Lower 48?
From where?
The Lower 48.
Well, what's appreciable? I mean, yeah, it's important. I mean, that, for example, there's a significant wild salmon fishery in Puget Sound, chums. There's significant Chinook fishery from time to time.
If Canada say 1/5 to 1/7 of Alaska's Lower 48, say 1/100 of Alaska.
Some of that comes in. So it's complicated. There's a lot of wild salmon comes in from the Lower 48 states, and it's tends to be mostly locally marketed in those states. Wild salmon comes in from Canada, from their troll fisheries, from their net fisheries. But it's small. It's incorporated in that, see that line, imports all other? So any Canadian salmon would be included in that imports all other, in Canadian wild. Now, let's look at the trend in U.S. imports. And this shows Atlantic fresh fillets at the bottom and then Atlantic frozen fillets in the red, and then Atlantic fresh
but non-fillet form, just sort of whole Atlantics. This is all imported Atlantic salmon that's dominating U.S. imports. Now, the fresh fillets come almost all from Chile. And so you see in these sort of, in the import trend, you see this dramatic fall off in the imports from Chile due to that downturn they had in production. And then the frozen fillets come partly from Chile, but also from Canada, and then the green is Atlantic fresh, much of which is from Canada. So what happened in the U.S. market is kind of a leveling off in imports for much of the 2000s, and then a decline in imports due to this fall off in Chilean production, and then a spike in imports over the past year and a half. I'm going to talk in just a couple slides about the price implications of that, but I want to just tell you briefly about where some of this other, where else in the world salmon goes. And the main thing is that farmed Atlantic salmon markets have diversified tremendously, and they've developed new markets. Like in the past 12 years, from 1998 to 2011, Russian imports of salmon, farmed Atlantic, went up from 12,000 metric tons to 147. Russia is now Norway's largest market for farmed salmon, even though Russia is a wild producer. South America is up from 8 to 45, and then other countries all over the world. So the salmon farmers are aggressively marketing everywhere. This is where Norwegian salmon goes now. It goes all over the world. You know, the EU is by far their biggest market. France and Denmark and Poland, by the way, are reprocessing countries. A lot of reprocessing happens. There's not like the Danes eat a salmon a night. It's a lot of salmon goes there and then gets reprocessed. But countries like Japan, other parts of the Far East, China are important markets for Norwegian salmon. Here's an interesting story. The Norwegians recently took a terrible hit in their exports to China of fresh Atlantic salmon for the Chinese domestic market. Can you guess why? The Chinese basically stopped importing. Can you guess why? The reason is that the Nobel Peace Prize Committee, which is Norwegian, gave the Nobel Peace Prize to a Chinese dissident. And the Chinese got really annoyed by that and basically boycotted Norwegian salmon. So if Alaska ever gets into the Peace Prize business, we better think carefully about that. Chile has also diversified. The USA is by far their biggest market. Brazil, however, has become a major market for Chilean salmon. So thank God that the salmon farmers are diversifying, because if they were only targeting traditional wild salmon markets, then prices would be quite depressed. Okay, I'm coming near the end. What has happened to farm salmon prices? What happened during the 2000, basically, they went through the same trends as wild salmon. The prices of farm salmon collapsed in the 1990s and then grew dramatically for most of the 2000s. The reason they grew is because they expanded world demand so much. They found new markets, and even though production was growing, they grew demand so much that they were able to get stronger and stronger prices. And that was part of what, and I'll talk about this in a second, part of what helped pull up wild salmon prices too. And then they had this price spike from 2008 to 2010 or 2011 due to this shortfall that was caused when the Chilean production collapsed. So prices were sort of growing gradually, and then prices spiked when the Chilean salmon production collapsed. But then as the Chilean production rebounded, prices collapsed over the past year and a half for farmed Atlantic salmon, or fell dramatically. It's sort of the same longer-term price trend in Japan, with showing the Chilean coho and Chilean trout. I don't really have time to go into that, but it was a similar pattern in Japan. here's the important picture. This is the trend in Atlantic salmon prices over the past 6 years. And you see this price spike in 2010 and 2011, and then this price collapse in 2011 and 2012. And so this is what was concerning me and a lot of people in the processing business. We're really concerned going into the 2012 season. If you look at sort of the price, what was going on in prices, they were worried, is this farm salmon price collapse going to drag down Alaska salmon prices in 2012? And the answer is, the short answer is, and I'll talk about this just a little bit more, yeah, to a certain extent it did. This decline in farmed Atlantic prices in 2012 is what basically why the frozen and fresh prices dropped somewhat in 2012. But it wasn't as bad as people worried. It was a lot less bad than people worried, and partly because we had a low harvest year, and partly because we were diversified, and partly because we've got a sort of our own market reputation that protected us, and a lot of factors. And then the final part of this picture, the good news is the farm salmon prices have strengthened quite dramatically in the past few months. This is the graph I made for that conference last week in California, and there they, because of antitrust rules, they wouldn't allow you to show prices after September, so I haven't updated these after September, but basically it shows a rise in prices. So the good news is the farm salmon prices have been rising again, but where the farm salmon world is at the moment is uncertain, because they don't know whether the Chileans' production is going to come back and stabilize or come back and keep growing and keep growing dramatically and crash the prices again, or whether maybe the Chileans will have disease problems again and the prices will rise. So the salmon farmers are facing a lot of uncertainty. But at the moment, there's a feeling of optimism that things are going to be better this year. And here you see that, you know, sort of just the sort of mirror image relationship with farmed Atlantic fillets that happened in the U.S. market when the imports fell off. Okay, finally, to wrap things up, I want to talk briefly about sort of what drove this price recovery since 2002. Okay, so here I'm finally going to leave. So far I've been trying to just talk kind of facts. I'm going to sort of try to give you just a little bit of my analysis, and other people might dispute this analysis, but this is basically my analysis. And I think the main point is, if you look at why did things improve so dramatically since 2002, it's partly things the Alaska salmon industry has done and should be justly proud of. But it's not only things we've done, it's also partly things that have been happening in the world salmon markets around us. As far as what Alaska has done, sustained effective marketing. ASME and the other marketing programs and the regional marketing programs, the emphasis is on the sustained and effective. We've put significant money, state and federal, into marketing, and it has built this Alaska seafood brand, and it's built the Alaska salmon brand, and Alaska wild salmon is increasingly recognized as a high-quality product in markets, not all markets, but many markets in the U.S., in Europe, and it's important that we've done this year after year and built this brand. I think that the agencies that have worked on this, and it's been the ASME and the regional agencies and the federal funds that came in several years ago, and the processors have done this together. There's been very effective niche marketing in certain markets, like, you know, Copper River is the famous one, but other markets as well have sort of developed particular brand identities and use those. The Alaska industry I've talked before about diversification of
products and markets. And this is just sort of three countries I just sort of selected at random: Germany, Poland, the Netherlands. These are countries we didn't export to at all 10 years ago, and now it's not like they're huge markets, but every extra market helps. New product forms, and I think the sockeye fillet, which you can see in markets all around the country, is probably the single biggest example, but there are many other product forms. This has really helped boost this industry. It creates new demand, it attracts new customers, and it takes supply pressure off traditional markets. And it's a great product. In my home, we eat sockeye fillets about at least once a week. Dramatic improvement in quality, ongoing. Certain problem areas like Bristol Bay was traditionally viewed as a problem area. The problems aren't all solved, but there's been a lot of improvement. You know, for example, the percentage of product that's chilled, and just handling practices across the industry have improved. Not everywhere, but there's been, you know, things are going very definitely in the right direction. And that's taken a lot of effort by a lot of people, and in major investments by fishermen and as well. But to go back to my other point, it's not just that the Alaska salmon industry has done all those things. It's also that global salmon market conditions have been favorable to us over the past 10 years, except for this fall in prices over the past year. This sort of growing demand that pulled up salmon prices has been part of what's been going on. Like it or not, in terms of our frozen and fresh production and portions, and not the canned markets, not the roe product, but those other products are competing head-on in markets around the world with farm salmon. And that competition is what, when salmon farmers glutted world markets in the 1990s and drove their prices down and ours. And after 2002, they helped grow world demand by expanding into all these markets and developing these new product forms and training new consumers. And prices improved around the world, and we benefited. Let's hope that they don't glut world markets again. Hope they've learned their lessons. It wouldn't be nice to hope that they have disease problems, but probably their disease problems are not over. And all these things will continue to affect us. Now, I think an attitude you're likely to hear in Alaska, hey, there's no comparison. Our Alaska salmon, wild salmon, is different, and it's better, and anybody knows that. You can't, I wouldn't eat that garbage that's farm Atlantic salmon. You'll hear that said in Alaska. But I think that there's no question that there are many, many consumers around the United States and around the world who definitely know what all Alaskans know, that Alaska wild salmon is a lot better. But not everyone knows that. And actually, not everybody even thinks that in blind taste tests. You like what you're used to eating. And even if a competitor's product is worse than yours, it still affects your prices. If a competitor's product gets really cheap, it's really hard to sell your better product for as high a price as you would have. If some consumers switch when prices change, then it can drag your prices down. So my point is, increasingly Alaska wild salmon has its own niche market. It has market recognition. It can hold its own, as we saw this year, in pricing even when farm prices are down. But we're not independent of farm salmon prices or world market conditions. And then it's important to note there are some markets where we're not competing with farm salmon, like canned markets and roe markets. And market conditions for those products have been strong, and that's helped us. And I've talked about this. We've been helped by rapid world demand growth. We've been helped by growing incomes in new markets, like in Russia, China, Brazil. We've been helped by new product forms. We've been helped by more types of retail outlets carrying salmon. We've been helped by more consumers becoming familiar with salmon and understanding the health benefits of salmon. We've been helped by the slowdown in world supply growth. And we've been helped by higher feed costs for salmon farming, which has helped slow things down. Finally, what about the future? And you can talk about the short-term future, like 2013, and you can talk about the long-term future. As always, the short-term outlook, like what's going to happen this year, is uncertain, and it's going to be affected by a lot of factors that are really hard to predict. It's going to be affected by what the Alaska harvest is. If we get a low harvest, or especially an unexpectedly low harvest, it tends to push prices up. If you get a higher than expected harvest, or just a big harvest, it tends to push prices down. Like they say, we're going to get a big, much bigger pink harvest this year, or probably we will. That just sort of normally that would mean a lower pink price. We're going to get a lower sockeye harvest in Bristol Bay, they say. Normally that tends to push prices up. But the preseason forecasts, as we all know, are not necessarily accurate, and every year brings surprises. So who knows what the harvest will do? Then we have to look at what happens in Russia and Japan with their harvests. We have to look at exchange rates, which I haven't talked about, I don't think there's any significant change that they're driving this year, exchange rates, although it will become a factor as the season approaches. We have to look at farm salmon market conditions. In particular, the Japanese farm market has been depressed. I didn't talk about that. It's been flooded with coho, farm coho. That's a factor. That market has been strengthening. We have to look at the European and U.S. farmed Atlantic markets. Those markets have been strengthening, which is good. We have to look at factors affecting Alaska processor costs, such as the volume that processors get affects their unit costs. And things like visa rules for foreign workers can affect their processing costs. So a lot of stuff goes into it. But overall, I'd say going into 2013, things look relatively favorable from a market perspective. But I'm not going to predict beyond that. Every year brings surprises. You can find reasons if you look to be sort of more optimistic or to be concerned. And then it's going to vary between species and regions. Here's an interesting article that's sort of on the good news front. This is just out of Intrafish magazine. This isn't in your handout, but it'll be in the version I gave you. I just added this morning when I was reading the news. Intrafish, which is a website that has news articles, says the U.S. there's a sockeye frenzy in the United States. Last year, shorter than usual sockeye salmon season is in the past, but there's a shortage in inventory of high-quality frozen sockeye. Everybody's looking for product. So that's good news. And that's good news in the market right now. Will that sockeye frenzy continue next year? Well, if we've got a shortfall in production, it probably will. How about the long term? I think that there are many reasons to be optimistic about the future of Alaska wild salmon. These include growing global demand. It's likely to continue because world populations are growing, incomes are growing, particularly in countries like China, Eastern Europe, Russia, India, Brazil. People are becoming more health conscious of the benefits of salmon, which is a particularly healthy product. There's new product forms continually being developed. Our wild salmon's in limited supply, and there's still a lot of potential for further niche market differentiation, and we're not going to flood ourselves out of the market because it's in limited supply. And furthermore, there are sort of potential limits to the future growth of farm salmon production. They're still subject to disease issues potentially, and the fish oil and fish meal could become more expensive. On the other hand, there are potential future challenges that you always have to keep in the back of your mind as you think about wild salmon. The biggest issue for me long-term for the Alaska salmon industry, in my mind, is not markets but resource uncertainty. Regime shifts, climate change, these could be good for some species, bad for other species. You know, we're told that regime shifts and climate change could be part of what's going on with Chinook salmon, could be part of what's going on with sockeye salmon at the moment. But this is very hard to predict. There is a potential that salmon farmers, particularly the Chileans, could push their production past what the world demand can absorb and glut markets and depress prices, as has happened in the past, as happened as recently as 2012. That could happen again. Hopefully it won't. There's potential. Another longer-term issue is there's all these other fish species that are increasingly being produced in aquaculture. Tilapia, barramundi, pangasius, which you may see in the stores in Anchorage. You see this product called swai. That's a product out of Vietnam, otherwise known as pangasius, otherwise a kind of catfish. Now on the top 10 list of, whoever heard of it? And now it's one of the top 10 species consumed in the United States. My wife brings some of this stuff home from time to time and says, this stuff is really good and it's really cheap. And my wife usually brings home Alaska salmon, which I love, but this other stuff isn't bad. So how many other people in the United States and the world are like my wife, and what happens if none of them are like my wife? But in terms of salmon, they're like my wife. These other species could begin to compete with us. And then there's always world economic uncertainty and then political uncertainty. So you never know. The wild salmon business, we depend on a wild resource. There's challenges. But I think that I'm basically optimistic, I think you got to be in this business. And with that, I've been talking for a long time, so I'll stop.
Thank you. Are there questions? Well, I really appreciate the presentation. You know, this was a lot of focus on a single species or a single fishery in this state, and even though we might say pollock is a huge component, it's actually harvested by a fairly small group of fishermen and an industry that doesn't have the reach into small communities across the state. And the salmon industry is probably the basic infrastructure, the basic economy, the basic job creator all across coastal Alaska in the communities themselves. And you know, there are some big inputs like you know, on Alaska, I mean, we're talking huge industries with the catcher processors as well as shoreside deliveries. But across the breadth of Alaska, I think that salmon is probably the largest driver of the seafood industry, which is, like I say, the underpinning of most coastal economies. So really appreciate you coming and giving us this background. We'll be looking at some of these things over time. We may send you some questions based on as we go through this analysis. So thank you very much. And any follow-up questions? So thank you very much, and we will be adjourned at 11:30 today.